Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are on the air tonight for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues that are confronting us in our daily lives. Ultimately, we hope that this show assists listeners to live their lives with more awareness and greater happiness. There is a hidden population in Juneau, in all towns, really. There are people who may look just like ordinary folks, but who have a hidden disability that terribly limits their lives. In school, they may seem bright, especially on verbal tasks, but they may also appear lazy or disruptive, endlessly repeating the same mistakes. As adults, their problems become worse. Drinking and drug use are common, as are criminal acts, often landing them in jail. They are often exploited by others. Women in this invisible population often have multiple unplanned pregnancies, their children ending up in foster care. And all this suffering because these men and women, through no fault of their own, were exposed to alcohol during gestation. And because our society has not yet found effective enough ways to limit the harm and human suffering that fetal alcohol spectrum disorder creates. So into this seemingly dire situation come two Juneau activists, Rick Iannolino and KJ Metcalf, who have focused their energy on helping those affected by the brain damage of FASD to lead the healthier lives. Welcome, Rick and KJ.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you coming in. Rick, several years ago, I interviewed you about FASD, and I actually went back over that interview that I had saved, at least my script, and I realized, and this is after I wrote up what we're going to talk about today, and I realized we're covering really much more of the social issues this time rather than the clinical.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm going to ask you, because a lot of people, understandably, really don't know the details of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, including why it's called that. But before we do that, let's start with Rick. And could you tell us how you became involved in this whole subject of FASD?
Well, I've been working with children and families since 1967. And I noticed a lot of the kids that I worked with did the same things over and over again. And some of them were quite serious. And they'd say, I'll never do this again. They explain exactly what the rules are. And then 5 minutes later, sometimes 10 minutes, maybe an hour later, they'd be doing the same thing. And it happened consistently. And I was wondering, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with these people? And it went on for years, wondering why this was.
In what context were you meeting?
I was working in a children's home.
Yeah.
We had 25 children in 1967. They had these huge warehouse of children.
Oh.
And they lived there. These kids were raised there.
Okay.
And
well,
so I knew
call
them very well.
Orphanages.
Well, they were.
But they weren't necessarily.
These kids who got into trouble and were sent into what they called homes.
Oh, okay.
It's a euphemism for an institution,
mm-hmm.
Children's homes. And then when I came to Alaska, I noticed some of the same things with children, different situations. Then I moved to Bethel, and I became the treatment director for the group home there, and I started treatment for the first time. And I'm noticing, and one of the things you need to know is I know the family history of all these families, because I'm doing with treatment and stuff. So I have real detailed records of their life and their family situation. So drinking was a big deal, and drugs were a big deal.
You mean common in these kids' lives?
And all these.
Were parents
and, yeah,
who drank a
but
lot.
I didn't quite connect it yet. I hadn't connected it at all. Yeah, the parents were drinking
uh-huh.
and taking drugs and in and out of jail, and many of them people dead. I mean, it was just tragic histories everywhere. I got to Bethel. And I really got to know the families, lovely families. And every one of them very openly said, I drank for the whole time. I'm really struggling with alcohol. And all these kids had this kind of behavior. Now, the kids who had FAS, full features. That means small eye openings called palpebral fissures, small philtrums, which is a groove under your nose, and real thin upper lips. That's called FASD. If they have those three markers, it's called a syndrome, and it's called fetal alcohol syndrome.
Oh, okay.
And it was
so
named,
you have to have visible features.
Yes, the syndrome is where you can actually see something
okay. That
indicates other kinds of damage, usually neurological damage in this case. Well, we know how to treat them. In fact, our kids did really well. We were really careful with them. We didn't push people. We didn't slow. We were kind. I mean, all those kind of things that really do work. But they'd go to school or in the community, and the first few days in school, they were out for a week for exploding in the middle of class. We were wondering, what's so different about when we're working with kids in a treatment setting as opposed to living in the real world, so-called real world, which is the school and the community and so on. And at one point, during this point, and a lot of the kids got into trouble. Some will be in, and I was also doing groups of kids. We had no services. Bethel has very few services, I should make guess. And had groups of kids who had been sexual predators to other younger children, and quite a few. I did treatment with them, with guidance. And later, when I came back to Juneau to work, I was invited to a Diane Melbourne presentation, school district and family. The parents invited me to come in, work with one of their children, their adopted children. And when she showed the photographs of children, she asked a simple question: which of these children is the most damaged? I've been a treatment director. I knew exactly who that child was. It was a small child, had full facial features with FAS, had small arms, and a lot of physical disabilities, very small stature. And I said, "Oh, that child there." And she said, "No." I said, "What do you mean, no? I can see it." She said, "No. You see that tall, beautiful sibling? There are four siblings. She is the most damaged. Why? Because she has brain damage. Her mom drank through all these pregnancies, and she can speak very well. She can analyze very well. She can give you all the right answers. But that's as far as there's something in her brain called corpus callosum that it translates information from one hemisphere of the brain to the other. And when that is damaged, it doesn't translate to the other side. So you can talk plenty, but you can't walk your talk. There's no bridge between understanding and behavior. Being able to do what you understand doesn't work. That's the problem we're talking about with all these individuals.
So it's the ability to reflect on your behavior, which is a form of abstract thinking. You have to reflect and analyze. Oops, I did this yesterday. I got punished for it. I was told it was wrong. It is wrong. I won't do it again.
Yeah, so if you don't do abstract thinking, that means you don't do time well.
Yeah.
You don't understand consequences. And memory is a big problem. You can't remember what you did. Well, if you can't remember and you can't do abstract thinking, guess what? Learning becomes a big problem. Being able to learn from consequences. I did this and this happened. That becomes a big problem.
Okay.
So it's very complex.
Right.
But all this stuff is connected to specifically different parts of the brain that are damaged during different times of the pregnancy.
Yeah, so it could be invisible. Like I was talking about this invisible population.
It's an invisible disability.
And the person with the most damage may or may not be the one who looks normal. In other words, they don't have the physical anomalies.
And they're the most damaged of all, which I learned that from Diane Melbourne, and that's been my experience. The kids who are higher functioning, who have a lot of social problems because of these kinds of issues we're talking about, who look normal, they get in the most trouble. The women, first of all, many, many times get sexually molested because they're very innocent. They tend to be very innocent, and they don't remember what happened to them before. And one family had the same lines all the time, and they would rape. This is family members. And they would rape this young woman over and over again. And what they said to her is, "Would you like to go for a walk?" And she loved walking. And then they would rape her. And every day she'd forget, and they'd do it, and somebody else would.
Short-term memory is also
short-term
impacted.
Memory is many times damaged. But every damage to every individual is so different, you can't talk about. one individual is having an FASD, a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and saying there's 256 specific diagnoses, and children have different behaviors. You know,
and is that why the term spectrum is there? Because of
spectrum,
the huge
spectrum. But there are patterns that are in common that are very common to people. It's like people with Down syndrome and other disabilities. There are some patterns that are noticeable.
And I'm going to ask you that in a second.
Okay.
But first, I want to welcome KJ.
Thank you.
Metcalf, KJ Metcalf, to this program. And KJ, how did you get involved in this subject?
Well, that's where to start. We've had a number of foster kids, my wife and I, over the years. We were interim house parents at the Juno Receiving Home, which was way back in the 60s. And we had, I think, a total of 9 kids there. And watching behaviors and just not understanding what was going on. And we've run a number of kids' camps. We lived in a village for 18 years. And
a village in Alaska?
Right. And just watching kids and adults and just trying to figure out what was going on. And then some years back, we were putting on a nonviolent training here in Juneau. And as a result of that training, some of us got together, Rick included, and we decided what are some of the peace and justice issues that we might work on. And Rick guided us through a conversation that identified FASD as a significant peace and justice issue. Started looking at the prison population and the people who were arrested and the incredible pain and social cost, as well as the economic cost that occur as a result of FASD. And so we said, well, we didn't know what we might do to address that, but we might have a conference. And so we organized the first Southeast Regional FASD Conference. I think that was in 2007.
Okay.
And then we had another one in 2010 and another one in 2012.
Wow.
And so the idea was to kind of help people understand what this disability is. And we also found that the folks who are affected, those who have an FASD, found the second conference particularly as a place where they felt comfortable enough so they could start sharing what their life was like. And so the fact that these folks who are affected could stand up in front of several hundred people and articulate how the world sees them and how the world and how they see the world was incredibly powerful, and has spurred me on to work particularly with those who are in prison, adult males.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I've been spending a lot of my time, is just coaching some of these folks. And when they get out of prison, trying to guide them into some productive housing and employment and just keeping them out of jail. And a person who has an FASD, and I can talk about one man that I've been working with for a number of years, is about 37 years old now, and he has an arrest record that includes 42 arrests and convictions. And they're not horrible crimes. It's mostly breaking conditions of release, making the same mistakes that they made that got them in jail in the first place. And after they do that time in and time in again, again and again, they have an incredible record, and they're seen as a constant offender, and their incarceration becomes more harsh. And they find a lot of... I might add that one of the things... I'm always learning, and found that trauma is a huge part of the FASD condition. And a child that's born has already been traumatized in the womb by the mother drinking. The mm-hmm. brain has been changed because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's violence included, that's further changes that the
right.
child
yeah.
Takes on and changes the brain. And so they're born, and then there's these developmental trauma that happens in the first 3 years of life. And these folks that I'm working with in jail have all been traumatized.
So it's the double whammy.
Yeah.
Not only are there biological changes in the brain that occur in utero, but then the first years of life, particularly, parents arguing, fighting, even if they're not verbally abusing or harming, touching the child violently, the harm is done neurologically. And so these people most likely have two major harms done to their brain.
Yeah, then you add on top of that, most of these folks are alcoholics before they had a name. In other words, before they were born, they have become accustomed to alcohol, and it's part of their being and their craving. Their neural system is laying there exposed, and it's bathed in alcohol before
they're
born.
And Matt Felix, who used to be the director of National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependency, he told me that an individual affected by FASD, their brain is three times more sensitive to alcohol. So this is a third impact, which is they're way more likely, not only because of difficulty with judgment, but just biological sensitivity to alcoholism.
Right. And so you've got the onion. You start peeling away the various layers, and you find one layer of disability covering another layer of disability. And the thing that I find is that we, as a culture, we as a country are very broken. Our systems are not designed to be FASD friendly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're designed in a way that they become barriers to people with who are affected with FASD and their families to accessing services, accessing understanding, accessing support, and oftentimes because of their inability to access these helpers, they are discriminated against. They're often bullied, and then you begin to get more trauma piled upon all of these other disabilities.
KG, do you think when you say our system is broken, I think of two major aspects. The dysfunction of our penal system of jails in this country and compared to other rich nations, because I've taken a look at how, for example, prisons in Northern Europe operate, and also the paucity of social services. Since our money goes elsewhere, we have a huge standing army and military costs that other developed countries do not have. The social services are really in short supply for people with FASD.
Well, we have I've looked at some figures, and we as a country spent over, in 2010, $80 billion on incarceration. And we have the highest incarcerated population per capita anywhere in the world. And in Alaska, I don't know where we stand in per capita incarceration, but
we have the highest rate.
Yeah, it varies often.
The highest rate of incarceration per capita?
If not one of the highest, in the upper
10 anyway.
Uh-huh.
And in the last few years, our prison population in Alaska has grown much greater than our regular population has grown.
Oh, really?
So we are imprisoning more people, and most of those are reoffending. Not necessarily reoffending, but breaking conditions of release. You know, a person with FASD is told by the judge that they are not to drink and they're not to associate with other felons and so forth. But what do? They go out and someone says, let's go have a drink. It's a good idea.
Right. It's not neurologically possible for them to learn a lesson through punishment.
Right.
And Rick, I'm gonna move back to you and ask you, what are some of the common features? Not that everybody with FASD has it, but the common features of FASD that lead to lives of desperation, lives where they just don't fit into society.
Well, as we said, there's a few basic things. Memory.
So short-term memory.
Short-term memory loss. Inability to understand consequences because you don't understand issues that involve anything that's abstract. Sometimes numbers. So many times in school, they fail real quickly. Many people have very different auditory processing, many times very slow.
So very slow processing.
So they're in school or you're talking to them and you tell them something and they don't want – nobody wants to be thought they're dumb. So everybody says, and they shake their heads, yes, yes. And they really don't understand what you're saying because they're processing so slow and we're speaking much faster than they can understand the words coming through that they're lost and they remain lost. And the longer you talk, the more lost they are. And they have – and they'll say, will you do this? Yes, I will do it. Well, they don't even know what you said.
Mm-hmm.
In school, when the teacher is going through the lessons and so on, if the teacher is not trained and accommodations aren't made, which can be made and can help children, but usually they don't know it's an invisible disability. They don't know the child has this, and unless they've been diagnosed. But anyway, I don't understand what's happening in school. So they tend, if you're sitting for 40 minutes in a class, and you don't, after the first 5 minutes, you don't understand what's happening, you get pretty bored. You get pretty upset, and they start, you know, playing around, making noise, walking around, agitated, just mm-hmm. frustrated. And, of course, those are problem children. They're disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kids, we've had kids that well, parents work so hard getting the homework done. Many, I'm not talking about a few, and they do their homework. It takes them many, many times longer because of the processing mm-hmm. problem. So something it would take maybe a student 20 minutes will take 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I'm just making this up. But it's something like this. And they'll put the homework in their pack, and they take it very faithfully to school. They've done it, and they're really happy they did it. And they worked really hard, and they forget to turn it in. It's short-term memory, remember? They don't remember.
Yeah.
I was in an IEP, an individual education plan,
uh-huh.
where this kid had a whole semester not turned in, most of the semester had not turned in anything. And the parents said, we know. I mean, we're there. We know it's there. And they had the pack there. I said, check the pack. Homework was in the pack.
It was right there.
I mean, piles of homework.
Oh.
This poor kid just didn't remember.
Yeah.
And so the accommodation was every day when they come in, check the pack. And that worked.
Yeah.
That did work.
And that was an accommodation.
Yeah. But this kid, in the meantime, is looking as lazy, non-compliant,
right.
resistant, and all that, dumb, whatever. And all those kind of negative stereotypes that even professionals sometimes put on these children.
Mm-hmm. We're going to break in a minute for some music. And I'd like to ask either KJ or Rick about the musician we're about to hear. And his name is
Morgan Fawcett.
Morgan Fawcett. And is Morgan from Juneau?
Yes, he is.
Okay, wonderful. And I've heard Morgan speak, and I've heard Morgan play the flute. And so, KJ, would you tell us about him?
Well, Morgan is a young man who grew up on the streets in Juneau and by his own testimony was headed for jail or being homeless or dead. He was in a very abusive home setting. He was delinquent. He was couch surfing. He was stealing food to keep alive. He was sexually abused. And his surrogate grandmother swooped in as some shining star and picked him up and saved his life. And so he is a poster child for a person with an FASD that has support.
Uh-huh.
And he has turned his life around. He has done amazing things. He is, Rick can talk about some of his history, but he also found music. He picked up a flute and he'd never played it before, and he picked it up and he started playing it. And music plays a huge role in helping people heal with NFASD.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started composing songs. He doesn't write music, and he doesn't play the same song twice the same way because he can't remember.
Yeah.
But he produces beautiful music, and the Samantha song to Samantha is the one that we're going to hear first. It is actually his sister, Samantha, and his surrogate grandmother swooped her up, too, and probably saved her life. And he is so attached to her that he wrote this piece that he particularly is fond of in honor of her.
Okay, let's hear it.
It's near and dear to my heart. This song has a dedication behind it. This song is for my baby sister, Savannah. That is why I call it Savannah's Song. And I play it in her name and in her love. And I offer her every time I play my heart and my soul. Because that is the only thing I have to offer. And I love you, baby girl. This is Savannah's Song.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight are Rick Iannolino and KJ Metcalf, and we're having a conversation about the trauma of fetal alcohol disorder and the spectrum disorder and the possibilities of a community response. KJ, you mentioned that you have been supportive of people with FASD and you've met with people in the prison. How do you identify these people? And I'm thinking there may be some people in our audience who would be very interested in volunteer work around this issue. So tell me how you did it.
Well, the folks I work with are not identifiable by the facial features, which Rick talked about, because those facial features occur only when the mother drinks in the first early part of the first trimester between mm-hmm. like the 15th and the 21st day. So it's a tiny window.
Uh-huh.
And that's 10% of the people who are affected by FASD have those facial features.
And they disappear with adults because we all look different and they literally disappear unless you're really well trained. They look like everybody else.
Oh.
So I've had people tell me, well, I don't think they're affected because they don't have the facial features.
Yeah.
But it's mostly the behavior and knowing the family history. And occasionally there are diagnoses.
Uh-huh.
But most of these folks are not diagnosed. It's just kind of a intuitive sense. They're doing the same thing over and over again. Their mother drank. You know, the family sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But how do you make the connection?
Well, from one prisoner to another.
Yeah.
And the system isn't set up to let me do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can be on the visiting list of one prisoner,
mm-hmm.
and they won't let me see another prisoner when I'm on that one visitor's mm-hmm. or one prisoner's visiting list. So a lot of time it's phone contact or working with them when they get out of prison.
If somebody who is listening would like to volunteer to work with individuals in or out of jail with FASD, should they contact you? How would they do that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. Yeah, they could contact me, and my number, home number, is 586-6738. But they can also work with the FASD partnership through the... let's see, that would be Terry Tibbetts through the advisory board, the governor's advisory board on alcohol and drug abuse. And there is a statewide FASD partnership, and they deal with a lot of these issues. And that might be a place to also make some connection.
Would you like to repeat your phone number in case people have
586-6738.
Great.
But we've always wondered how many people are affected who make up part of the prison population.
Right.
And we don't know. But just observationally, I've talked to the administrators of prisons, and they think that 20 to 30 to 40% of the prisoners have this disability or some similar disability.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of folks who are in there who don't get the help that they need, are not identified, and a number of these folks are in there for child abuse, sexual abuse of mm-hmm. minors, because most of them have been sexually abused as minors.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to know something about prisons, that a sexual abuser of a child is the lowest of low in prisons, and they are targeted for extortion, sexual favors, brutalized. And so, again, it's more trauma on trauma.
Well, how poignant, because obviously punishment does not change behavior. With people with brain damage from FASD. And so here we have people needlessly in prison, in that prisons are supposed to be reforming people, teaching people a lesson so they don't reoffend. And obviously, neurologically speaking, that's impossible.
Yeah, I need to say one thing, that Child abuse, sexual abuse of a child is a horrible thing. And even though these folks are broken because they were abused badly as children, there is that important role of safeguarding the public, which you have to acknowledge and have to take care of. But there has to also be some alternatives to the kind of treatment that they get in prison.
The public could be safeguarded, perhaps in another way. Rick, what do you think?
I was going to mention that the whole justice system is overwhelmed by these individuals. When you're thinking 30-40% of your people coming through court, the judges are seeing, the probation, the police are arresting, the attorneys are working on either defending them or prosecuting them, and so on, and the jails are just full of these people. They're overwhelming the system, and a very expensive system. And I concur with, we need to find a different way and a better way and a more humane way of working with people with a disability, an invisible disability, but one that can be clearly determined through a diagnosis. And what they're looking at right now is possibly screening prisoners, not diagnosing, because they can't. We don't have the diagnostic capacity. Even though our clinic in Juneau, when I was coordinating it, we did see adults. We were one of the few.
We should mention that Rick Iannolino was the coordinator of the FASD diagnostic clinic in Juneau for how long?
About 10 years.
10 years. Okay.
Close to 10 years, yeah.
Okay.
But we did see, we're one of the few clinics in the whole country, by the way. There's just a relatively few. I think Canada has one left that diagnoses adults. So we really lost something there. But anyway, this is a – go ahead, KJ.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, Elaine. Let me tell you about two women who live here in town.
Okay.
They're homeless. They're chronic alcoholics. They're live on the streets and live in the woods. And between them, they have 20 children. They have had 20 children.
Uh-huh.
And each one of those infants was taken away from them as soon as it was born because of, I mean, they've been brutalized, they've been raped, they've, these pregnancies, just one after the other. And I think there's that empty nest scenario where they say, maybe I can keep this child, but it's taken away. So that's 20 kids that have been born in this community, and all of them are affected. All of them have FASD.
All of them have FASD.
And so then you have the two mothers, and their mothers probably had FASD, too. So that's 22 people. And nobody knows exactly how much it costs the state of Alaska to maintain a person with an FASD during their lifetime, but it's at least $1 million. So there's $22 million that's because of this situation. What if we had taken some of that money and put it towards support, housing, a healthy pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
What a difference that would have made in the lives of those people. Plus the fact that those 20 infants are now sexually active age, and they're affected. And so, you know, this goes on and on and on. It's intergenerational. And if we had taken some of that money that it's going to cost the state and put it towards support, housing, caring for people, what a difference that would have made.
Rick, you gave me an article about a home on the East Coast for individuals with FASD. Either of you, could you give me examples that are either working? For example, Whitehorse, as I understand it, has more services for people with FASD.
Quite a bit. They have a diagnostic clinic in Whitehorse that's funded. They have universal health care, so they're able to actually pay their teams. And they have they've had a team for many years, consistent team for many years. They have, UConn, FASCI it's called, Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. FASCI, UConn, yeah, that's what it's called, UConn, FASCI it's called. And they've had housing, supported housing for people with FASD for many years. It was started by a mother of one of the people, and it's government funded. And what happens is the people are diagnosed, and then what their needs are determined, and they have a tremendous amount of support. Somebody has to always be on awake and around these housing, supportive housing, so that because these individuals, you know, people will prey on them either to molest them, steal their money, use their cars, steal their objects, molest their children. I mean, it goes on and on. Yes. So you have to have a presence of somebody to protect them in this kind of supportive housing. And they make sure the houses are clean enough and that they food, you know, the food's not spoiling them and getting sick. I mean, there's a lot of things that go on. They also help them find jobs that are appropriate. And I guess Canada has all these support services, like, you know, lots of case management. They have a system for caring for their citizens, which we simply do not. You know, our money goes to military. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
Just follow the bucks, and yet that's not hard to do. So that's why UConn has so many more services. They're not burdened by the kind of economic burden we have in this country as being a warfare state rather than the welfare of our people.
A warfare state rather than...
People are very proud about a warfare state, but we're not very proud about we put down a welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand that, but that's how it seems to be.
You've said that what is needed for somebody with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is an external healthy brain. In other words, another person who will help guide them, a job coach. So could you give some of the tips that when I know you're having a conference coming up, you're developing a workshop for family and friends of people with FASD. So when you do training, either for, you could say, prison guards or for teachers or for parents, what kind of strategies do you suggest?
Depends on the age, first of all. But strategies usually deal with each one of the issues that come up. I had mentioned auditory processing being slow, about speaking slower, having more times for people to do things, more time for people to respond, fewer things to do, maybe one step at a time on a complex task, one step at a time. When that step's done, then the next one. But a piece of paper, maybe with that one step, and then the next one is the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And people can do that. And they can do it in a time that will – and then you learn about the person, and you learn about how fast or how slow they process. And, you know, and that takes a lot of training for staff to learn that about one person. Every person is different.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some technological aids to me one time.
Telephone.
Cell phones and tape recorders.
You know, nothing's perfect. Tape recordings are helpful so they can listen to it over and over again. They can slow it down or listen to it over and over again, and they
mm-hmm.
can actually, their auditory processing can eventually catch up with everybody if they record it.
Mm-hmm.
Videotaping is good.
Mm-hmm.
Photographing steps of a task are good.
Mm-hmm.
Cell phones are great for contacting and for reminders and calendars and beeps. It says you're supposed mm-hmm. to do something, and they look at it, and the calendar says, you're supposed to do this in an hour. Get on a bus. You know, and get there on time. This is your, you know, and it's not perfect because, you know, they're very, my experience is people tend to be very generous and open-hearted. They'll loan their phone to somebody, and it disappears many times, or it's stolen. But as long as they have a phone, that's good.
I think research has shown that an understanding that if we treat FASD-affected people from a perspective of developmental trauma, many of their symptoms can be reduced. So if you treat the two with some of the same strategies, folks do better.
Uh-huh, yeah. And I would presume that this, in the supportive living, you'd have people who are trained in this. And I just, it really brings to mind people with dementia or people with Alzheimer's. When you're trained as a nurse to work in a memory care unit, you would learn how to be accepting of these disabilities and not blame the individual. So one thing that it would seem that, you know, putting myself in the shoes of somebody who has FASD, it could be incredibly frustrating because people would blame me They'd blame me for my disability. They would think I was lazy or not trying hard enough. And there's also a higher incidence of suicide, isn't there, among people with FASD?
Right, there is. And when you say we blame the child or the adult for being lazy or not understanding or stupid, so often we blame the parents for being bad parents.
Yes.
And that compounds the issue. I work with some of these families, and I can tell you that they're a family that has three or four adult children who have an FASD is absolutely in total chaos. And I wonder how these parents can even function. But they do an amazing job, and they're such strength, and they're so brave. But they have to develop strategies that work. And so in these workshops where we talk about what works, we use a lot of these family members who have, by trial and error, figured this out, and they can share what works for them. And that's a really powerful statement.
And how important to have support for the caregivers. Because being the parents, whether you're the adoptive or the biological parents of one or more children with FASD, could basically drive you to the grave, I would think. It would be so exhausting.
Yeah, good point.
I've worked with a lot of parents and grandparents who are caring for people with FAS, both adults and children. Sometimes you have grandchildren as well you're caring for who have FASD too. And one of the things about adults, as one person said, with FAS, it's sort of, when you think of people, adults with FAS, you think of sort of the wicked fountain of youth. It was mentioned. Everybody looks the age they appear to be, and nobody acts the age they appear to be. You are a child forever. And that's one of the issues, and for all these adults with FAS, is that they are functioning at a much lower developmental age and emotional age than they appear. I mean, I have one person who's 60, was functioning, I would guess, around 14, very much younger, younger, and 60 years old, has grandchildren, brought to the clinic their grandchildren with him.
Right.
And I asked his wife, I remember, I said, you ever studied adolescent psychology? And she said, well, no, she's a professional woman. I said, no. And I said, why? And I said, well, you ever noticed that he sort of acts like a young adolescent? She said, well, yeah, now that I think about it. But this is the kind of thing that doesn't occur to you. And I can tell you something. Most of our staff and most of the agencies across the whole country, I'm not pointing at Juneau only, but including Juneau, if you have young people coming in to these services, you know, it doesn't pay a lot, turnover is high, and you see somebody doing the same thing over and over again, the assumption is they are doing it on purpose. And so people get really angry with these children because, you know, they don't learn.
Right.
And they're doing it. They're really defying me. I told them not to do it, and they did it.
Right.
So there's a lot of sort of emotional difficulty and abuse with understanding with the staff of many of our provider agencies. Even understand that, you know, if there's one thing I would tell anybody who works with somebody with an FASD is, number one, learn a little bit about it. Believe it's real. Learn. Study it and try it out. You'll see it's real. And learn from people like us who work with people. Just watch us work with people, and you'll see it works. You don't get all the negative acting out behavior you would if you had negative assumptions about the person. And be kind.
Kindness.
The core of service for people who have disabilities, who cannot change, who did not do this, they were born this way, is if you saw somebody in a wheelchair, they're missing an arm or whatever, you would help them. You wouldn't judge them and treat them badly. But people with an invisible disability, even though diagnosed many times, are treated very badly.
Okay. I think one way to help us gain some compassion are your stories about real people with FASD, including Morgan Fawcett, who we heard earlier in the program. And let's play one more song by Morgan on the flute, and hear the talent. And actually, in the last song, what I heard was incredible emotion, beautiful emotion coming through that flute. So I'm going to ask my technicians here, do you have music for me? Okay, let's hear it. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm here, this is Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and I'm here in the studio with KJ Metcalf and Rick Iannolino. And we're talking about their activist work with individuals who've been affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And so we're talking about the young man who just played the flute a moment ago. Rick, did you have something to say about him?
Yeah, real briefly, Morgan, most of what we hear about adults with FAS tends to be somewhat negative, and certainly there's a lot of hurts in people's lives and this inability to do some things. But Morgan, for instance, is one of the people with tremendous support. That's what you need to support is success many times. He worked in the White House mm-hmm. as an aide to President Obama. He worked in Congress. He's in college. He was a Fulbright scholar. He's got at Georgetown University. He currently is in working in California in school, and he's getting his grade point average is quite high. But he works 12 hours a night on homework, which most students don't do. But he's a good role model that way. There are many people who really do succeed with support. Uh-huh. It's just that most people don't have support.
And what kind of support does he have right now while he's in college?
His grandmother. He lives with his – he's an adult. He's 22 now, I think. And he lives with his surrogate grandmother and grandfather and his niece, who they're raising as well.
Uh-huh.
And he has his own portion of it, and he has very – he's very disciplined. And he has – you know, and so he goes into his room and works on the computer – Okay. With a lot of supervision, because computers are problematic too, because of what just like smaller, earlier, younger children, it's problematic in some areas. So
yeah.
You have to watch that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
KJ, you were going to add something before our time runs out.
Well, you know, we talk about some of the huge issues that face the community dealing with FASD, but there are some bright spots. There are 6 diagnostic clinics in the state, which has come up a little bit, so we're able to diagnose a few more people. Great. Diagnosis is the gate that most folks have to go through to get any kind of services, and certainly to be recognized by the justice system that they have a disability. And again, so few people are diagnosed that's problematic. But Senator Kevin Myers in 2012 shepherded a bill, SB 151, through the Senate, and went through the House and became law without a signature by the governor, that said essentially that someone who can prove that they have an FASD and committed a crime, that the judge can take that into consideration as a mitigating factor in sentencing. And so that was a big step, and that was passed in 2012. But the sad part is it's never been used. And the lack of diagnosis is a significant part of that problem, but also the fact that a lot of judges don't understand it, and some of the attorneys don't understand it either. So as we have these conferences and there's more information that gets out, we hope that people get educated about what the help is that is existing out there.
It's not hopeless.
Yeah.
And our time has run out. And before we sign off, I want to thank Ricky Annalino and KJ Metcalf for being here this evening. And thanks to Jeff Brown for all his program support. Then, if it wasn't for the technical expertise of John and Dolly Kramers, I would not be able to do this show. So tune in about a month from now, Monday, December 8th, and Mind Over Matter will air again at 7 p.m. Thanks, Rick and KJ. Good night.
Thank you.